Welcome to Talking Insights, the podcast that dives deep into the world of market research and insights. This month, we're embarking on an exciting journey around the globe with our new series, Polling Around the World. In this new series, we'll explore how elections are conducted, how public opinion is shaped, and how market research intersects with the democratic process. 2024 saw the most elections ever recorded globally, with more than half the world's population participating in votes ranging from local to national referendums. So whether you're a political junkie, a data enthusiast, or just curious about how democracy works, this series and this episode is for you. So we're kicking off this journey in the United States, and today we're thrilled to be joined by Katy Frankovic, who is one of the world's leading experts in public opinion polling and has been an election and polling consultant for YouGov, CBS News, and other research organizations. She's also a member of the Professional Standards Committee and also a big friend of us and member of SMR. Katy, you spend decades analyzing how Americans vote, what influence their decisions, how polling has evolved over time. I mean, it's just such an honor to be talking to you and to learn more from your expertise. So thank you very much for being here, Katy.
Thank you. Thank you. It was very kind of you to say those things. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. And I wanted to start to talk a bit about the past, to create a bit of, you know, create a bit of a context. We came a long way since 1824 and the methods used at the time, the straw polls and all that. And like with the new use of technology, the internet, social media, nowadays we have so much more information. We have the predictions that we make are kind of more realistic. And so I want to ask, like, and looking back at those pivotal moments in the U.S. election history, like the 1948 defeat Truman headline, what can we learn from these instances and where polling kind of missed the mark?
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I think we always learn from one election to another of what to do better. The 1948 problem was that for many of those, like George Gallup, like Elmo Roper, like Archibald Crosley, who were doing election polls in 1948, they thought they'd learned a lot from starting in 1936. So in the last three elections, what they thought they learned was that campaigns never change election results, never change minds. And they all stopped polling 2 weeks or so before the election, saying, okay, we've done it. Campaigns don't change minds. Dewey is ahead. Well, you know, then they learn, oh, yes, they can. And the last few weeks before the campaign can alter the outcome. So that lesson got learned then. In 1980, something similar happened. What was expected to be a very close race between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan turned into a 10-point victory for Ronald Reagan. Oh, why did that happen? And when did it happen? It happened just in the last few days before the election. Again, people who were doing polling said, oh, we've got it. We're putting it out on Sunday. Tuesday's the election. Nothing's going to happen. Well, things did happen. There were more issues with hostages in Iran and Carter's dealing with that and management of that. And so then people learned, well, maybe we need to be tracking things over time. So we had a couple of decades of a lot of tracking polls, a lot of things being done until the night before the election. At the same time, and I think this is worth mentioning, we started transitioning from, well, after 48, really, basically in the 60s to the 70s, we transitioned from in-person interviewing face-to-face to telephone interviewing, and then starting in the 2000s, but it probably began in the late 1990s, transitioning from telephone surveys to online surveys. The internet became far more important with its values, in other words, speed of conducting surveys, privacy, a feeling among respondents that this was a better way to ensure their privacy, but also problems in that for a long time, the people who were online were not necessarily a proper reflection of the American electorate. They were better educated, they were wealthier, and so on. Now, that sort of has changed a bit over time. And now, in fact, I would say that most election surveys done in the United States are done online and not by telephone. Done online, sometimes with probability samples, sometimes with panels, sometimes with panels that the people conducting the survey control, sometimes with purchased samples. So there's a lot happening there that can either work well or work poorly. I think that the lesson of the 2024 election, sort of, we started learning this in 2016, but I think the lesson of the 2024 election is our notion of national public opinion polls telling us who is going to win an election is not the way it's done. That we really, there are a lot of state surveys that are done, but given the nature of the American political system, national polls may tell you who wins. They could tell you who wins the popular vote, but they're not going to tell you how a number of states that tend to be very close are going to go. And so, in 2016, we know that Donald Trump was elected over Hillary Clinton, even though she captured the popular vote. We know that it was a matter of tens of thousands of votes in three states. Had they changed, Hillary Clinton would have become president. In 2020, Joe Biden had a comfortable lead nationally, but managed to get elected because of about 120,000 votes in three states. Had they gone the other way, it would have been quite exciting to see what would have happened. And finally, in 2024, we had a close election, and the swing states that mattered did all fall in Donald Trump's direction, which gave him a pretty substantial lead in the Electoral College votes, which is how America decides its presidents. I mean, and I think we forget that. We forget this constitutional requirement. I think people overseas, people in the United States forget, but people not in the United States may not even be aware of this or have not paid all that much attention to it. So, I think, come 4 years from now, I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot more of the well-known and reputable pollsters spending more of their efforts trying to see what's happening in those swing states, in those states that are known to be close and likely to continue to be close. That doesn't mean we won't have national surveys. We want them to tell us why people are voting the way they are, but we may not talk about them in the same way we talk about them now. And I think we put too much confidence in them, basically.
Right. And that's really interesting because that was kind of my follow-up question. I was going to ask about these, especially the last three elections and what kind of caused these discrepancies in some causes. But also, if you think that for some way, especially with the last three, we lost some kind of trust in the polls, and how have the pollsters worked around the challenges?
Well, I think what was fascinating too, and this is a U.S. problem, U.S. issue, is that we have a tendency to rush to judgment. And we knew that the first popular vote totals, because of where they were counted and because of how states count their votes, were going to favor Donald Trump. They favor the Republicans. You have a lot of states in the South. They tend to be Republican states. You have states that can count easily because they're smaller states. They count quickly. And I think a lot of people this year rushed to judgment. If you looked at the comments online in organizations that are full of people who do public opinion polls, like APOR, the American Association for Public Opinion Research, and WAPOR, the World Association for Public Opinion Research, you saw comments about the failure of the polls. We had the failure of the polls again, the third time round. And no, that's not true. Because and some people would write and say, wait a minute, you have to wait. Now, it may be embarrassing for a country like the United States to have to wait 5 days to know exactly what the final vote outcome is going to be nationally. But unfortunately, that's the way it is. And I think we just all better be aware that that's probably going to happen in the future. See, states decide how to run their elections. They decide when their polls are open. They decide what the rules are for absentee voting, for voting by mail, for casting ballots early. They decide all of that, and they decide how they count the votes. Yeah. Can they even open the envelopes that were sent in by people casting mail ballots before Election Day? If they do, they can, they don't count them, they can organize them so that they can count them quickly on the day of the election. If they don't have that rule, they can't even start opening an envelope and validating somebody's eligibility to vote sometimes until Election Day, which means they're just going to be slower and slower when it comes to counting up those votes. And so, I mean, California is a terrible example, is a state that counts slowly, doesn't necessarily have counting of ballots at the precinct itself. Everything's transported in some counties to a central counting location. So all of this just takes time. And it's just hard for us, I think, to imagine that in a country like the United States, it would take so long to count the votes. We expect this in some countries. We don't expect it here.
Yeah, I think sometimes, especially the people outside of the U.S. kind of forget how big the country it is and the amount of people that are voting. And especially in smaller countries, like when you compare it to like countries in Europe where they're fairly small compared to the U.S.
And there's one rule. You know that the rules about counting votes are the same everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case in the United States, where we are a nation of states and 51 separate election units with the 50 states and the District of Columbia. It is in, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 time zones, maybe 6, you know, stretching from the East Coast of the U.S. to Alaska and Hawaii. It consequently it just takes a long time. So when the polls close at 7 o'clock, say in places like Indiana, or 7:30, say in a place like, I think it's West Virginia, and those votes start being counted, they're not necessarily representative of what the final outcome is going to be.
Right. You know, I want to also mention and talked about like the influence on public opinion, and especially early on you mentioned about the technology and like how like social media and the internet are working with and against sometimes with the polls. With this rise of the big data and social media and everything, how has polling adapted to integrate it and sometimes exclude and navigate the ethical considerations, everything with this?
Wait. You know, I think, you know, people who do opinion polls are still tasked with the responsibility of producing a replica of the American public, however they define it. However broad the reach of social media, it is not necessarily, and the active people on social media may not and probably are not representative of the country overall. It means that you have to be pretty careful when you look at what's coming out from there, but you have to look at it. I think it's a representation of the public. In the 19th century, there used to be parades in support of candidates, and you could physically see on the street how many people were marching down the street with torches supporting, oh, I don't know, Grover Cleveland or someone like that. And surely people were looking at that. People looked at editorials in newspapers. People look at things. But, you know, we have to do that. But we know that there are sort of good ways of producing a sample that's going to represent the entire electorate. And that you can't do just based on looking at social media, of any kind of social media.
Right. And that's kind of like with the more younger and marginalized groups and everything. Like, do you think eventually there's going to be a certain difficulty in reaching some kind of representative sample?
You know, there is. I mean, there always is. And there always has been. And one of the things that's happened is that over time, the response rates of people who've been asked to participate in telephone surveys, where they're called and selected through some randomized process, the response rate from them has gone down, has dropped dramatically. And I would say, about 30 to 40 years ago, people were troubled because the response rate was less than 50%. Now it's in single digits. So I think that's also made people much more interested in trying to find alternate ways of reaching people. That's probably also expanded the number of surveys that are done with panels or otherwise done online, which can still be done through representative samples, either using mail lists or doing pre-screening phone calls. So, you know, there's work. I mean, there's a lot of work that's being done in the United States and I'm sure elsewhere on how one can manage this. Yeah.
When I was working and researching more about this interview, one of the things I found really interesting, mostly because of my age, and that's something that I'd never thought or occurred to me because I'm too young to be on that generation to uh-huh. happen. But the phone calls and then someone asked you like, all right, who's the next to do the birthday or who was the last in the family
yes, yes.
or the household to do the birthday? I found that really interesting and how nowadays things are, or at least I think, are so different. The methodologies used are so different than back
right.
then.
Last birthday. That's it was very popular. I mean, it was seen as a way of getting past the original way of sampling by household or telephone. And that was of listing everybody who lived there, every adult who lived there, and then randomly selecting one. And that seemed really intrusive. So the last birthday could be method could be used more simply and without trying to figure out exactly which people are living in that household. You still need to find out how many adults are living in the household when you do that, but that's it. So I think that's you know, the people you learn, you test, you see how you can fix things or make things better. And then you move on from there. I think I'm not sure what the big takeaway from 2024 is. Clearly the importance of the Electoral College, a reminder of how important the Electoral College and that's really the decider in American politics. And then some sort of attempt to try and work with that on the national level. And you can do that with oversamples in states. In particular states, you could do that by looking differently at the groups of states that you think are going to matter. We can always hope that in 2028, the election is going to be such a major victory for somebody that this yeah. won't be a problem. And the biggest criticism is that, the polls suggested this person would win by only 12 points and he or she won by 15. Fine. That's easy to deal with. I think that, you know, in saying it was a close race, which everybody said, with aggregates of surveys showing basically Kamala Harris won by 1 point over Donald Trump. I mean, or sometimes the same, or sometimes 1 point in the other direction. And to get criticism from people saying you have to get the winner right in that circumstance on a national level, I think that's a pretty unrealistic expectation, given what we know about the value and the use and the accuracy of pre-election surveys, of even very good pre-election surveys. There is a margin of error. There always is a margin of error, margin of a degree of potential error, even apart from the statistical one.
And do you think that technology will help make that error in a more minimal way or minimize that error?
I don't know. I think it would be nice if we knew it could. It would be nice if we knew how to reach people, how to reach a random sample of people by a snap of our fingers. But I don't think that's going to happen. I don't. I could be wrong. We'll learn, you know, in 2 years, we'll learn a lot more. And I think
That's really interesting. I wanted to also talk about the Professional Standards Committee. And I wanted to ask what it is, what it does, in a more simple way, like what's the committee for?
Well, there are some things that it's specifically tasked with. And frankly, I don't know how long the Professional Standards Committee has been in existence. I don't know whether it's been in existence since the start of SMR or not, or whether it was founded several years later or many years later. But is a committee that is made up of senior members of the profession from globally, senior members of the profession globally, and we are tasked with setting standards, reviewing standards, reviewing and creating guidelines, reviewing guidelines on processes that have been with us a long time, and creating guidelines on processes that are new. And we spend a lot of time now talking about AI. We spend a lot of time talking about other ways of measuring opinion. And remember, I come from the opinion world, opinion research world, but most members of SMR are doing marketing research. So market research. So also, you know, new ways of dealing with that. So I would say that every year there may be one or two new guidelines presented. We are tasked with working with the ICC in the development of the SMR ICC code. And that's been with us for a very long time and is currently in the process of reviewing and updating. I'm not part of that group, but others on the committee are. We also have a subcommittee, the disciplinary committee, which is the first place that people who have an issue, a problem, a concern, or that someone may be violating the standards that exist, the first place they go. And the disciplinary committee is tasked with investigating it and proposing what should happen, whether this case continues to go on or whether it should be dismissed. There's a very long and lengthy process that any of these cases have to take before they are finally resolved. That goes through yet another committee and goes to the council. So I think you should probably bring Judith Passingham, who's the chair of the Professional Standards Committee, in for discussing that process. I sit on the disciplinary committee, but that's just the first step. And what we may say or what we may think doesn't necessarily reflect what happens.
All right. We will for sure. And just to finish up, I just want to ask another question, which was more related to you. You've been working with polls in this industry for a long time. You have a lot of expertise in the area. And I was going to ask, what was your favorite project that you worked on your career? What was your favorite thing that you worked, top of mind?
Well, I you know, top of mind means what I've been thinking about in the last 2 days or a week. We did some very innovative things at various points in time. And I started at CBS News in 1977, so this is a very long time. We did some very innovative things. We partnered with the Tokyo Broadcasting System in the 1990s to conduct joint surveys in the U.S. and Japan, which was eye-opening for me because of what I learned about the conduct of news polls in Japan, how they were done, and how one had to think and adapt one's thinking to the way people in other societies may think. One cannot take the U.S. model or the U.S. rules or the U.S. ways of asking questions, just simply transplant them. So that, I think, is important. I'm happy to see that there are organizations that care about public opinion and election polls. I'm happy to see that, you know, a company that I've worked with in the U.S. in exit polls has been doing exit polls in Venezuela for a long time, and which provides for some check on the validity of elections. I think that's very, very important. I once had to, I don't know if you know how many people have their own version of Survivor, the television series.
Yeah.
Where,
I really like that show.
Well, the very first Survivor in the United States became very famous, unbelievably popular. So that the producers had a massive party host on the last show, when the last show was aired, when Richard Hatch became the survivor. And we were asked if we could do something with our polls that would allow us to see how Survivor fans viewed this. This was a lot of fun, actually, because I got to go out to LA and be there at the party, but I spent most of my time in the control room with the graphics for the polls. And, you know, I worked for a news organization. We're sometimes discovering immediate reaction, even recognizing that immediate reaction might not last forever. Immediate reaction to debates or to, in this case, the outcome of an incredibly popular television series that was on CBS. And we were able to do a lot of things and still feel justified and still feel proud of keeping to the rules of good polling involved a lot of callbacks to people whom we'd pre-interviewed, and we could get things on the air in 15 minutes after an event was over. Now, those are very stressful circumstances and very stressful situations. You don't want to do them all the time, but doing them can be a lot of fun. And then they're over and then you're happy. It's not something that can go on for a very long time. Okay, that's that. I think we've also, but I have to say this too, we also learned that events happen and that it is important to see where Americans are in after serious events. I mean, really serious events like the 9/11 attacks and so on. And so that was some other things. And I've been happy since I left CBS and I retired from CBS, I've been happy to be able to serve on some organizations' reviews of the situation in countries that we don't necessarily think of as leaders in the democratic process in terms of measuring and figuring out whether the country was ready for opinion polling. And so I've been to some places that and met people in places that I've just been so proud. I've been so proud of them. And I'm so impressed with all of them. So it's a very long answer to a simple question, and I did not give you one thing, and I will not give you one thing because
No, but it's good. I always found it so interesting, like how the different areas of entertainment, bowling, the more serious and more unserious parts of life kind of mix and have some common ground with this that you were just mentioning, like the survivor, and then doing that. I think that it's so interesting, like how these different parts of life just interconnect. And ever since I've joined SMR, I've learned so much, and I met some incredible people doing what you're saying, like in different countries that you're not even thinking that sometimes there's some problems regarding elections, pollings, or public opinions, you know, and then you learn so much from how different things are in those countries. Yep. And I think it's been interesting.
And I think I've said this, I know I've said this in many other places. I mean, you just really have to be always learning, and you have to always be paying attention to what the issues and the problems are. And it helps. It helps you the next time round. And it helps you when you talk to people like yourself about where we stand in the research world.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And one of the points that almost every episode, I don't know how many episodes I've done so far, 30 or whatever. In almost every episode, we kind of mentioned that, like, you need as a company, as an individual, as a professional, to make your homework, to learn, then keep interesting, keep interested in the areas that you're working on, and keep interested in learning more. If you stop learning, that's the end of it.
That's true. But I think that, yeah. I agree.
Well, thank you very much, Katie. I won't take you much more time. It was a pleasure talking to you. It was really, really interesting. I learned so much, and I hope we get to talk in the future some more.
Talk about the... Let's not wait until the next presidential election in the U.S. Maybe sometime.
No. Okay. No. Absolutely. There's so many more questions that I have. Next week, we'll travel across the Atlantic to explore polling in Europe. From Brexit to the EU referendums, we'll uncover how polling shapes a continent as diverse as it is interconnected. And speaking of Europe and polling, next month, SMR is preparing an event in Brussels called the Citizens Insight Summit. This is a premier gathering designed to explore the intersection of insights, public policy, and democracy. So join us on February 19 in Brussels. You can find all the information on the episode notes, and please don't forget to like and subscribe. For me, that's all this week, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye!